When you come to Unbound, especially for our Send program, people generally are looking for three things. They're looking to figure out what's next. How do you help me figure out what to do next with my life? They're looking for how can you help me have marketable skills, like how you train me to do things that I'm going to do next? And can you help provide a community that helps me do that? And the answer, of course, you know, from a marketing standpoint is yes, we can do all those things. But what is amazing to me is that in the last little bit, there's a lot less what's next questions and a lot more can you give me a community and can you give me marketable skills? In other words, there's a clarification here, and all of a sudden people feel like we're motivated to do something. And yet, if you scratch a little bit beneath the surface, there's still like a, I am all spun up. The engine's at high RPM, but I have not dropped it in gear yet. Mm-hmm. And I haven't dropped it in gear yet because I'm not exactly sure where I'm steering to go to.
Lots of fuel, not so much on the direction yet.
That's right. And so it's like all of a sudden the engine was at idle. The engine's now close to redline. But we haven't dropped the clutch yet because we're not really sure where we're navigating to. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Be Unbound podcast. I'm your co-host, Jonathan Brush.
And I'm your co-host, David Rethemeyer.
It's great to be back with you, and we're looking forward to a conversation today. We've got some great guests coming up. We're looking forward to introducing you to them. David has become the schedule juggler par excellence, which means he's done a lot of juggling recently, and it's been really fun, and I'm just really glad David's around to do it. But somewhere in that juggling, we had a slot open up here for us to do this podcast by ourselves, just the two of us, and that was actually quite helpful because a lot's happened since we've had a podcast between the two of us, and there's a lot to talk about. And personally, a lot's happened for me. Some of you may know, and if you didn't, you should check this out. I got a chance to fly out to Washington State and record a podcast with Heidi St. John, and that was released just a few days ago. So if you want to go to Heidi St. John's podcast and take a look, there's a fun conversation. And that was recorded just a few days after the Charlie Kirk assassination. And so that was a topic of conversation. And also, David, what was interesting was that I got up super early in the morning. I flew on a flight to Portland, Oregon, and then the next day I turned around and flew back. And on every flight, so that flight was a commuter flight for me, a hop from Charlottesville to Atlanta, Atlanta to Portland, then Portland to Atlanta, Atlanta back to Charlottesville. And, you know, I'm semi-conscious because these were very, very, very early flights. And so I'm sitting in my seat, and you know how you kind of sit and you can just kind of, this is maybe my own weird way of saying it, but like kind of cast your ears out. Like, you know, like instead of just sort of tuning out the background, you sort of try to break it apart. Yeah. What was fascinating to me was that at any point that I did that in the flight, I could hear Charlie Kirk's name. And I wasn't close to any of those conversations, and I knew if it was positive or negative. But I don't know that for me, in my lifetime, there's ever been a cultural moment when a person was literally on the lips of everybody in any situation I was in. And so, no matter what your position here, there is no doubt that this is the eighth major level political assassination in the history of the United States. So just by the nature of that, it's pretty interesting. Five of those are politicians, two are civil rights leaders. So you would say that the Kirk assassination sort of stands out a bit in that. And I believe that it will wind up being a watershed event that has an impact and an influence downstream for quite a long time in terms of the way our culture works. Now, I don't know exactly what that looks like. And unlike a lot of pundits, and I'm not a pundit, I have no desire to try to explain to you what that looks like. But I am pretty confident that we'll make a difference, and therefore it's worth pausing and talking about. And for us, all of our students are talking about it. And so this is a topic of conversation. So, David, this is not so much like a where were you when, but, you know, obviously this has been a conversation you've been a part of as well.
Yeah. I think the thing that has stood out to me and to you as well, we were just talking before we started recording about how much of a response this has had in the young people that we work with on a regular basis in Unbound specifically. There was a lot of conversation, a lot of just processing the fact that none of them had ever really seen anything like this happen. And the fact that this was, for some of them, it was somebody who they had a lot of respect for and they really had watched for a long time and saw as a leader to look up to. And there were others who just maybe didn't really even know him or maybe disagreed with him to some respect, but just the fact that something as just gruesome and just no holds barred evil, something to that extent occurred to somebody like that was just really sent people reeling and I think made them have to process a lot and ask a lot of really hard questions. And I think really has just sparked a lot of conversation, a lot of like taking time to process. And then also, you know, we were just discussing the fact that it sparked a lot of desire for change, a lot of desire to do something about the fact that we live in a world, in a society where something like this happened, and wanting this to never happen again, and wanting to see this be something that doesn't happen again, and what that looks like. And so, yeah, it's been a really huge moment. And I think you had some observations as well about just some of the conversations you've seen too.
Yeah, and I think we wanted to go that direction. So maybe it's helpful to just sort of jump in here a little bit and say some things we're not doing here. We actually don't have a lot to say about Charlie Kirk. And just to be really clear to our audience, it's not because there's not a lot to say, and it's not because we think that's unimportant. It's just that we don't claim any kind of inside knowledge. Neither David or I were personal friends with Charlie. We don't work with Turning Point as an organization, and that's not because we wouldn't want to. It's just there's more organizations we don't work with than we do. And so we don't have any direct connections and relations. And I know a lot of people who do have those direct connections. One of our former students was actually heavily involved in the Turning Point organization as a contractor for the company he works for. Obviously, Heidi St. John, whose podcast I was just on, knew Charlie personally and knew a lot of the people connected to that. And so they all have perspective and things to offer from that angle that are important and I think are worth saying. We don't have those things, and it's ridiculous to pretend that we do. Nor do you tune into this podcast, I think, for some punditry in terms of, you know, like our opinions about all those things. I have them. We've had conversations about them, but I don't know that this is the right place for that just because we're not qualified in that particular arena. What we are qualified in, and what has been interesting to me, is that, you know, from the memorial service on, there's a definite call to action and a call to revival that has been really strong, really moving, and really powerful, and I think really has impact that we are going to see for generations, if not, I suspect, for the rest of my life. And I think that's interesting. And the call and the movement is something we can claim some connection to, because if you're speaking broadly from a Christian standpoint in terms of a call to faith and a call to revival and a call to discipleship and a call to building the kingdom of God, well, we've been following that call for quite some time. And if you're talking about it in terms of what do we do next and what action is, you know, what can I do? Well, our day job is training young adults who constantly ask that kind of question. And so here's an interesting thing, David, that I've observed, even as we've had some admissions conversations and things like that with our folks who are interested in Unbound. When you come to Unbound, especially for our SEND program, people generally are looking for three things. They're looking to figure out what's next. How do you help me figure out what to do next with my life? They're looking for how can you help me have marketable skills? Like how do you train me to do things that I'm going to do next? And can you help provide a community that helps me do that? And the answer, of course, you know, from a marketing standpoint is yes, we can do all those things. But what is amazing to me is that in the last little bit, there's a lot less in my conversations. There's a lot less what's next questions and a lot more. Can you give me a community and can you give me marketable skills? In other words, there's a clarification here. And all of a sudden people feel like we're motivated to do something. And yet, if you scratch a little bit beneath the surface, there's still like I am all spun up. The engine's at high RPM, but I have not dropped it in gear yet. And I haven't dropped it in gear yet because I'm not exactly sure where I'm steering to go to.
Lots of fuel, not so much on the direction yet.
That's right. And so it's like all of a sudden the engine was at idle. The engine's now close to red line, but we haven't dropped the clutch yet because we're not really sure where we're navigating to. And that's the place that I think is worth having a little bit of conversation, because I think for me, there's both a desire to speak into that because I have opinions about where that ought to be. But also, I think there's an opportunity here that's quite exciting. So, David, does that match some of your expectations and observations? Match your observations.
Yeah, I think so. And I think this specific circumstance is fairly new and unique in some of the specifics about it. But as in terms of just a dramatic and just tragic event like this happening and spurring people to have a lot of motivation to do something with it and getting inspired to go out and create change in a world that they can see is very clearly broken and needs change. That's nothing new. That's been happening since the dawn of time, essentially. And so I think we are just in constantly looking for what is the best way to go about that. What's the best way to channel that? And I think that you'll hear a lot of different perspectives on that. You'll hear some people who like lean a lot into the activism side of that say, yes, look at the things that are wrong with the world. You need to look at that, and you need to go out and you need to do something about it. Get involved with whatever organization is addressing the problem that you're fired up about. Go and do something immediately. And going and doing something like that and doing participating in stuff like that, not necessarily a bad thing. And then there's also the other side that's saying, like, slow your horses if, slow down if you just immediately go out and just do the first thing. And we aren't actually taking time to consider if that's the right thing or not. And we should just need to wait and let the people who are actually, like, in responsible places for this be able to figure it out. And then maybe we can do something and just take some time, reflect on it. And that's not necessarily a bad approach either. And so I think there's just a lot of observations about what should be done with that energy, whether it should be gone full speed ahead, whether it should be reined back in, and people should not be nearly as fired up to do something about it as possible. And I think, not to say that the answer isn't either one of those things, but I think that we can probably, I think that what we have in mind here is to suggest, some third, fourth, fifth options for what to do with that than what you might be hearing from the vast majority of media sources at this point.
Yeah, I was searching as we were preparing for this, David, and I was trying to think through some analogies and some things I could point to help understand this. First of all, like what David said, there are immediate action-based things, activist-type things, political-type things that people are being called to or being motivated to do. Just to be super clear, I'm in no way criticizing those or casting or disparaging them or casting any shade on them. There's just lots of people talking about those. So, there's not a need to have one more person jump onto that pile, right? And those things are important, and sometimes they're critically important. But it's worth noting something that we point out a lot. When we say that, okay, something has happened here, assassination, we want to change things in our country, we think about that from a political standpoint, and then all of a sudden there's a lot of political activism called for. Is that appropriate? I do think it's appropriate. I think that there's important things to do, and I think political action is required and is important, and as Christians, it's something we should be involved in, and that's one way that we can live out our faith. It also has this subtle message that the way to make change is to do something that involves fame, fortune, or power. And we talk about that a lot in Unbound, that if your definition of success is fame, fortune, or power, there's two problems with that. One, they're empty goals if you arrive at them, if that's the only reason you want to arrive there. And second, they're actually quite difficult to obtain, which is not to say you shouldn't go after them for those reasons. But if you think that you won't get anything done until then, you are sitting in a situation where you may never get anything done if that's where you think it's going to start. And our argument is not to not go after hard things, and it's not to take action. Our argument is that things change when ordinary people do ordinary things differently. And so to commit to being extraordinary to ordinary has two really major factors to it. One, it's a call to immediate excellence. So it's a call to excellence that permeates every bit of your life. And it's an assurance that through God, those normal everyday things that you're doing actually have an impact far beyond what you often can see yourself. And so, David, as I was kind of casting about for looking for some things here, I was trying to pick something that maybe is a little contrarian, and so it'll take a little setup, but I was trying to pick something that wasn't hot button so it would get distorted. I think Americans generally see prohibition as a bad idea, that prohibition was an ill-thought-out law that caused a lot of organized crime and ultimately was repealed for the foolishness that it was. And that's maybe perhaps not untrue, but it's certainly not the truth. It's not the entire truth. The entire truth is a little bit more nuanced and a little bit more complicated than that. And if you go back, the entire truth is that America had a significant, serious, deep-seated, broad, and very impactful alcohol abuse problem prior to prohibition. And that alcohol abuse resulted in colossal rates of domestic abuse, child abandonment, spouse abandonment, extreme violence, particularly in cities. The prohibition didn't come out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. When you get that kind of grassroots movement that gets laws to that sweeping effect, there has to be a reason for that. And there was a reason for that. And that was because, everywhere you looked in a lot of places, the abuse of alcohol was causing massive, serious damage to people in almost every conceivable situation. And so that led to political activism that resulted in political action that resulted in the banning of alcoholic beverages. Now, most people know the rest of the story that, that was an incentive for organized crime and it caused more violence and all those kinds of things was eventually repealed. And again, I'm not saying in any way that's untrue. What is missed is that prohibition also made drinking alcohol a criminal, out of society type of thing to do in most circles, not all circles, but in most circles. In other words, it added a social stigma to it. And that social stigma persisted far beyond the repeal of prohibition, to the point that there was a significant reduction of alcohol abuse and alcohol use across almost all segments of society post-prohibition. And because of that reduction in alcohol abuse, there was significant gains in fighting things like domestic abuse and child abuse and abandonment and all those kinds of things, right? Now, it's worth thinking about that because there's two aspects of this. There's a political activism piece that was important and was not unrelated to the things that happened that changed, but also many would argue was unsuccessful. It was repealed, or you can make all kinds of arguments about that. What really had long-lasting effect was the people who decided to do things different. The alcoholic who decided to stop being an alcoholic, and I don't mean to belittle that by the way I state that, but you know, somebody who went through the struggle, took the steps to say this is going to affect my family more. The families that said this is an unacceptable practice for us, that's not the way we choose to live. The communities that said we don't put up with that kind of alcoholic abuse and think that that's socially acceptable anymore, you have to use it in a different way. The people that, you know, the churches that said this is not what we expect of church members. Okay, it was those little interactions, it was those little commitments that ultimately lent themselves to macro behaviors, but on a micro scale, the impact on individual lives is almost incalculable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part that we want to think about and talk about. And I want to kind of, you know, I've got a passion here to share with those of you who are listening. It's the little everyday things that seem a bit unimportant that consistently, when applied consistently and over time and with endurance, have an exponential return. And that ultimately make far bigger difference than the political things that are happening, even though there is a connection to those political things, and I'm not arguing that we should ignore those. But yet, if you're looking for a call to arms, if you're looking to a call to action, if you're looking to do something immediately, there is an impact and an outcome that is far greater than you imagine in just the small everyday things around you that you can apply yourself to that are different from what everybody else is doing.
Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom to that. That's a really interesting example that you bring up. And I think the thing that stands out is that, to me at least, is that the actual passing of the law in and of itself wasn't the thing that actually fixed or helped to address America's alcoholism problem. The thing that actually addressed America's alcoholism problem was the overall cultural mindset change that came out of that result, whether or not that came through just because the actual prohibition law got passed or not, we can speculate. But the point is that it was a change in just how it was perceived and how people perceived whether or not it was a good thing or an acceptable thing to do and to see. And I think that the way that you could phrase it, and I think that we've talked about a lot in Unbound, is the fact that those people were endeavoring to create a new culture within their communities where alcoholism or things like that were no longer acceptable. And that's something that I think has, we can look at a lot of other examples throughout history, and I think is something that we ought to look to more today, is seeing how can we create a culture in which the things that we are looking to oppose, the things that we are wanting to be unacceptable, or the things that we want to change about our world, how can we create an environment where those things are unacceptable, where those things are just not even appealing anymore? What does it look like to do that? And I think in the case of the prohibition example, maybe that does involve some legal activism change, but I think a lot of it just involves just making a decision on how you and your family are going to behave. It involves just having conversations, having civil conversations with your neighbors and your community about why you think that is acceptable or shouldn't be acceptable or not. And is a lot of those things that end up stacking up. And those things, you'll notice, a lot of that is not nearly as much of an immediate, this is the fix, that if we just get this one thing done, then this thing is no longer going to be an issue. That's what a lot of the pundits and the media will end up gravitating much more towards is how can we just find the one thing that's just going to fix the problem? And that appeals to us as humans. It's our human nature to just look for the one quick and easy solution. But the reality is that the actual lasting solutions, while it can involve bigger steps, it can involve things like legislative action and like movements and, you know, supporting large organizations for political change, a lot of it also has to do with just creating the new culture to establish a new norm and say, we are wanting to make our world different because we have been equipped to do so. Choosing the right resources for your high schooler can feel overwhelming. That's why we created Equip by Unbound, a program for 9th through 11th graders that combines skills training, coaching, and community to help students thrive now and in the future. Through life and study skills courses, worldview training, and hands-on projects, students build purpose, resilience, and confidence. Don't wait. Enrollment prices go up soon. Learn more and enroll at beunbound.us/equip.
So, David, I want to take those ideas and I want to kind of flip them a little bit and I want to do something maybe a little unusual. The logical next step here is to say, okay, so we challenge you to go forward and do kind of normal everyday things and realize that they're more important than you think. Yes, we would do that. And we could provide an easy list, right? I might start by saying, you know, desire, unless you were called differently, and this is an important caveat to put in there, but most people aren't, unless you were called differently, desire to be married, desire to start a family, desire to have children, desire to have work that's meaningful and do all those kinds of things. Those are really good things to want. They're worth pursuing if you want them. They're worth taking seriously. They're worth prioritizing. They're worth doing well and with excellence. And they make a far bigger impact and they have a far better result than you expect. And that's true. But you already know that. And so that's just adding to the noise when you say things like that. Most people instinctively have some desire for that. We can maybe have another podcast where we talk about that. The problem is that a lot of people go, yeah, but that looks awful normal. Maybe it looks less normal now, but there's something mundane about that. And so there's this new thing that's been, you know, a lot of apologetic circles are talking about, you know, the enchantedness of work or the enchantedness of this or that or the other thing. And I think there's some level of putting the story back into why we do things. In other words, if I say work, you know, very recently, somebody would have been like, cubicle farm until you die, you know, until you retire, get the gold watch. And then that's when life really starts. And most people instinctively go, not that, like, you know, give me the weekend, give me vacation, give me something else, give me freedom, give me a van by the river, right? Something like that. And so, and that's not what we're saying. And so enchantedness would be like, oh, work's actually fun. It's really meaningful. Okay, I can get behind that a little bit. And I would actually make some of those arguments. But why is that? Let's think about this, because I think there's a desire among all of us to be the star, to be the hero, to be Luke Skywalker, to be the person that is moving everything forward. And I want to suggest something from a Christian point of view, from a practical Christian point of view, that is maybe uncomfortable and reassuring at the same time. And that is, I don't think you or I get to pick if we're that person. In other words, God chose Moses. Moses didn't choose to lead his people out of Egypt. God chose Joseph. Joseph didn't choose to get sold into slavery and then rescue his brothers. God chose Elijah. Elijah didn't decide to become a prophet. God chose Mary. Mary didn't decide to bear the Son of God. God chose Peter. Peter didn't decide to be the rock on which God built his church. God chose John. John didn't choose to be the one that was revealed, have the vision of Revelation revealed to him to write down. In between all those people were a lot of very ordinary people, some of whom are listed in biblical genealogies, most of whom are not, that provided the links and the structure and the context and the culture and the society that allowed Moses's and Joseph's and Elijah's and Mary's and Peter's to live, grow, and do other things, right? And they, I think, have an impact far beyond what they maybe knew. Did Peter's grandfather have an idea that his grandson would have the church built on him as a foundation, right? Did Mary's great-grandmother know that her great-granddaughter would Did Moses' mother know? I mean, we know a little bit more about her. And the answer, of course, is no, they couldn't, right? But, you know, there's, in Moses' case, obviously she took some action. But in Mary's mother's case, she successfully raised a young child who said yes to the angel. And so we can look at those links there. And so I want to challenge us to first release something and say, your job is to do the civilization building things that may look mundane, but are actually fraught with importance and fraught with peril, honestly, that ultimately builds the foundation upon which great things can happen. And then be prepared to step into the breach if called, but whether or not you're called is not your decision. And then the final piece of this is that something I've been thinking about a little bit over the last couple of weeks, David, is that, you know, we refer to classics and to myths that we can get a lot of meaning out of. And a lot of people get meanings out of the Odysseus and Homer and the Iliad and all those kinds of things. And I think that's correct. So I'm not arguing against that. However, I'm curious, and I have to do a little research. So I'm speaking a little bit of ignorance. So listeners, bear with me. I'm curious, you know, who exactly the audience for that was when it was written. I suspect it was written for a majority audience, not a singular elite, right? And mm-hmm. So this was kind of the popular fiction of its day, popular literature of its day. And the people who read it would have recognized and had some sort of connection culturally, even geographically, to the places being mentioned. So if you agree with me that way, there's a step, there's a leap that goes to the next place that says, well, is our modern myth the Iliad, or is our modern myth something a little different? And I would say that it could be the Iliad, and there's a piece of that, and that the Iliad informed this modern myth. But, you know, one that might make a lot more sense to most people listening would be The Lord of the Rings and Tolkien as the author, right? And so when I say those things, because the movies, because of the books, modern audiences understand that more. And because Tolkien wrote in a Western Europe context that both Europeans and Americans can more immediately relate to in terms of the characters, the people, the cultures, and even the geography. Now, clearly we don't live in Middle Earth, but Middle Earth was powerful because it reflected things that we could attach to, right, that we could understand. And if so, if that's true, then thinking about that myth in terms of what we're talking about here is this. The only person who could carry the ring was somebody produced by the Shire. So you can't have ring bearers if you don't have a Shire that produces them. Then that involves ascending, a going out. And the Shire cannot ultimately be protected from that which will come against it until those that come out return home. The Shire's burning, especially if you read the books, the Shire's burning, and it's Merry and Pippin's experience abroad that allows them to save their home at home. And there's something important about knowing both of those things, that your job is absolutely, positively to be Shire builders, to create the atmosphere that ring bearers can be trained and nurtured in. So when the call comes for ring bearers, you have rank and file to send them. And that ring bearer could be you. It could be your son or daughter. It could be your friend, community member, church member. And that's not up to you. That's up to God. But until you know that, then you need to be prepared to say, yes, Lord, send me. And in the meantime, you need to be working night and day, heart and soul, to build the kind of cultures and the kinds of families and the kinds of communities and the kinds of churches that are always ready to produce ring bearers that stand in the gap. And, you know, if we want to extend this out a little more, ring bearers, but also those who protect ring bearers, who assist ring bearers, who mm-hmm. run the diversions for ring bearers, who, you know, march to the gates of mortar so the ring bearer can slip in the back door. There, we can carry this analogy quite far forward, but it starts with you have to create the place where those folks can be trained, can be raised, can be prepared so that they're ready to leave when called upon. And that would be the challenge that I would want people to think about. You know, if you've got this itch, this burn, this passion, this desire to do something because of what you witnessed in these last couple of weeks and because of the things and the truths that you see somebody has sacrificed much for, that's good. And if there's an immediate call to action and some sort of activist type way for you to do that, don't let this in any way discourage you from that. But mm-hmm. if you don't have that immediate call and you're wondering, well, what does that mean now? Don't let that flame puff out and be discouraged. Instead, stoke it, add some fuel to it, and know that that may be the small little things now that end up being great big things with civilization altering impacts in generations past what you can see. And as a Christian, the good news is your timeline is longer than your own life. Mm-hmm. And you are not in charge of and have the responsibility of knowing if you're supposed to grab the ring and run to Mount Doom or not. God will make that clear if that's you or not. But you do have a role to play in whoever does do that when God calls them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think all that was phenomenally said. And I think the one thing I'll add on to that, which I think is something we add on to a lot of podcasts, but I think just remains true, is just recognizing the fact that because we are each made in the image of God, and God has stated that each one of us, he has a specific plan for how he is going to use us, it does us well in moments, especially like these, to dwell on that fact and to really observe that the God who orchestrated all of creation is orchestrating all of time and is ultimately orchestrating the redemption of all things, has a specific plan for you, me, and every other human being that is created in the image of God that you see, and especially for you, you get to be a part of that, and it's worth recognizing the tremendous amount of value that comes from that, the tremendous amount of responsibility that comes with that as well, and ultimately just the possibilities and just the hope that comes with that as well, because again, that last piece of he is orchestrating the redemption of all things and each one of us in ways that maybe we will get to see how we're going to be a part of it. And maybe we will just be participating in smaller things where we won't actually get to see just how much of a difference these small things that we do will make in the ultimate redemption of all things. But we are promised that each of us is going to participate in that in a God-ordained way. And regardless of whether that is leading the charge in activism, whether that is participating in some sort of change at a smaller, more supporting level, or whether that is just simply being faithful in the places that God has put you, having conversations and being Christ-like in the places that you are in or the places that God is calling you to be, as long as that is the goal, is to be participating in the ultimate redemptive plan that God has for this world, then you're in the right place and you are doing the work and you are putting your energy towards things that are eternally valuable.
Well said, David. We have indeed reached a turning point in our history in the sense that this will have an impact that will echo 4 years forward. And I don't know what that looks like. I can argue probably intelligently of all the good things that might happen and all the bad things that happen. But the fact of the matter is that no matter how intelligent that might sound, I don't know. But I am pretty convinced that there are forces in motion that will impact the way our world looks and acts and reacts in the years, days and months and years to come. And that has been true throughout all of history. There's never been a time when there isn't things like that that happen in history. And we can point to lots of them. I'm old enough to remember 9/11 and other things. And you can kind of, you know, anybody who's lived at any amount of time can point to those things. And so, you know, don't be surprised by that, but be excited about the opportunity and know that, as David so elegantly just put, you know, if you're participating in the work of redemption, that has major impact no matter where you are and what you're doing. All right. Well, as we close out, as we have been here recently, we have a story to share with you about one of our students, what that looks like in Ascend. Look, we're never shy about marketing and talking about what we do at Unbound. But I just, you know, turn this off if you don't like this, but I'm about to be aggressive about this. I just want to tell you that this is not new for us. Mm-hmm. That we have dedicated our lives, our time, our energy, and in most cases our fortune, to training and equipping young adults to thrive. And our definition of thrive is to do the kind of impact work that we've just talked about in this podcast. We've been sold out for this for a really long time. And I know this sounds immodest, but I'll back it up with you however you want. We are extremely good at it. And we add value to the students that come to our programs. We connect them to people in ways that are extremely, extremely powerful. We give them skills they need. We indeed help them to figure out what's next. And we put them on that path. And then it doesn't stop. And the last couple of weeks, I've talked to alumni who graduated 10, 11, 12, and 15 years ago that continue to reach back out to us for resources and help and guidance and lots of different things. And we're delighted to do that because we have even more people to connect them to. I just came before this podcast from a business that is running with multiple bouts of students that are connected because of Unbound. The things they're doing is revolutionizing the business and the cultures that they're in. And I could go on for a really long time. And if you give me an opportunity, I will. But the point here is, if you're looking for something to do and you need the skills to do that next thing, and that next thing is building the actual foundational keystone blocks of civilization, that's what we do. That's our day job. And it's not just what we do, it's what we excel at. And we're better at it than almost anybody else that you know. And if you want to know how and why, and specifically why that is, call us. I can back that up with actual empirical evidence and numbers. And so if this is interesting to you, if it gets you excited, if it gets you wound up, listen to this story, come to our website, talk to us, do more than that, join us. We're doing something big. We're part of something big. And we get to participate in the redemption of all things and would like to work with you as we do it. So until next time, be unbound.
Hi, everyone. My name is Abby Huseman, and I just finished my Ascend Foundations year. And looking back on the year, the impact that Ascend has had on me has been amazing. Like, I am not the same person that signed up for Ascend last June. Before I even thought about Ascend, I knew what I wanted to do after high school. I wanted to become a pilot, go to flight school, the whole nine yards. I started ground school, it went great, and then I started having seizures. And you can't fly if you have seizures, so the Lord closed the door on that. And after that, I felt stuck. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I had no interest that I loved enough to find, have a career in, and so I joined Ascend. And it was absolutely amazing. One of the things that really stood out to me this year was something that a speaker said at Basecamp, which is our second live event, and it was just push a button. And that has stuck with me ever since he said that. Essentially, it's try something new. It's okay to fail. You're gonna learn from it. Pick yourself back up. It'll be okay. And I used to be so afraid of pushing buttons that I just wouldn't. And I would miss out on so many amazing things in life because I was so afraid. And now, am I still afraid to push buttons? Absolutely. I don't know if that fear is ever going to go away. But I still do it because I know that it's okay if I fail. Or maybe I'll love it and it'll be amazing. An instance for that that actually happened this year was each student has to complete a personal project in the Ascend year, and mine was to train for and run half marathon. And I started to do that, and then my seizures came back, and my doctor said to stop running, so I had to change products entirely. And I decided, well, okay, let's just get my wilderness first responder certification. So I did, and I absolutely loved it. I had no idea that I would love it as much as I did. And so now, this fall, I'm going to get my EMT, and then I'll possibly go down the route to become a paramedic. And it is just so cool how the Lord just, you will make your plans, but he will direct your steps, and he will take you to where he wants you to go. And Ascend really helped me with that this year. And not only that, but the community is amazing. The friends you will make are fantastic. And I did not regret a single second of joining Ascend at all.